Hi, my name is Zach Call. In late summer of 2019, I started having headaches. I saw my doctor a few times and they just kept on getting worse and worse. By September 7th, I got to feeling so bad that I ended up in the emergency room. This is the story of the day that went down and the months that followed. I owe a lot to the game of golf. Hell, we all do. But golf literally was the answer to recovering, both physically and mentally, from the craziest thing that's ever happened to me. Thanks to the entire staff at the Golfer's Journal, to Jeff Cunningham for his art in the issue, and most importantly to Travis Hill for believing in this story and helping this all find the pages of number 15. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the ride. It was a crazy one.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Golfer's Journal podcast presented by Titleist, the number one ball in golf. My name's Tom Coyne, senior editor at the Golfer's Journal, and hey, big news. So this weekend, well, big personal news, I guess. After five consecutive years of failing to do so, I qualified for the club championship flight, in my club championship at home. So we're just going to talk about that this week, how that miracle of golf happened. No, we're not actually going to get too deeply into that, but it was pretty exciting. There's seven spots available, and I finally broke in there. And I just want to give a shout out and give credit where credit is due to my Pro V1 golf ball, of course, and tell you what, it's deserved. I mean, I was getting up and down from all over the place. It's the only day of the year we played the tees all the way back, and so the course plays really tough and needed to get up and down a lot. And if you don't know already, the all-new Pro V1 and Pro V1X, they've been reimagined from core to cover. You've got longer distance now, softer feel, even more greenside control, which I was really noticing. If I wasn't hitting a green, I felt like, you know, it was that feeling of like, well, I'm going to be down in two, you know, just because I know with the ball how it's going to come off my wedges, my SM8 Vokey wedges. Also hitting these nice, long, soaring drives off the TSI driver, not spinny, just sort of like boom, which was a lot of fun, was letting me keep up with the college kids I was playing against. So if you don't already have them in your bag, get the Pro V1 or Pro V1X in there, because as Titleist tells us, always bring your best. Now, as many of you know, one of the cool features, there are any number of cool features about being a Golfer's Journal subscriber, but on our website, you can actually go and listen to the stories from the journal itself. You can hear the authors read them. It's one of my favorite things that we do because, you know, how many times do you read a story or an article or a book or whatever, and you think, you know, I wonder what the author sounds like, I wonder what they're really like. And you can go on the website and, you know, click play and hear authors share their work, comment on it. If you didn't know we had that, definitely check it out. It's very cool. And I think one of the best we've ever recorded, well, it's the best we've ever recorded, is called A Life Rebuilt by Zach Call. And it was such a moving reading by Zach that we wanted to share it as its own podcast to hear Zach tell the story of his return from unimaginable circumstances. And then after he reads the piece, we're going to check in with him. We're going to see where he is, how he's doing, and what he's up to now. It's a conversation that I really enjoyed getting to get to know Zach a little bit. It's been one of the great parts of, well, there's a lot of great parts of this job, but this was really one of them. He's such an inspiring person. I hope you get as much out of it as I did. And as with all our conversations and our features and our essays, they're all made possible by our subscribers. Thanks very much for being part of the Broken Tee Society. And of course, our sponsors from the pages of the Golfer's Journal. And they are Titleist, Link Soul, Footjoy, Oakley, Links and Kings, and Scotty Cameron. So now, let's turn it over to Zach to tell us about the day his life changed in ways he could have never imagined, and how golf helped him get his life back, piece by piece, and step by step.
The drive from Portland to Hood River is a straight shot east through the sprawling woods of Oregon's Columbia River Gorge. For a 9:05 tee time at Indian Creek Golf Course, I left it at 7:15 with my clubs loaded into my truck and a podcast speaking to me about feeling worse for the wear. My thoughts wandered. Is 3 one too many swing thoughts? Or would the caffeine my primary care physician recommended help this pesky headache that I'd had for going on 2 weeks now? Or could the sun poke through these clouds by the time we teed off? I was excited to play with some of my closest friends, so when I couldn't use my right hand to pick up my coffee mug halfway through the drive, I passed it off as my body waking up. I got to the parking lot and timidly strapped my bag under the passenger side of the cart. I pulled driver at the first and hoped a breakfast ball would correct my right miss, and it didn't. I faked my way through the front nine, pulling everything left, resigned to the fact that I was posting a big number and determined to just enjoy good company. Half of that company peeled off after the first nine holes, so it was just Chuck and me for the back. Number 10 is a short, elevated par 3, and I thought wedge would be perfect, but I ended up keeping it in my hand a chip from well off the green. Again, left. Two putts and yet another bogey. Frustrated and out of ideas, I pulled out my green Sharpie on the 11th tee box and doodled some abstract shapes on my Pro V1. That didn't work either. See, Chuck is 60. He's my favorite golfing partner and a close friend. We approached a bridge on the way to 13, and I stopped to play a game that we'd learned at his home club, Pumpkin Ridge, during last year's member guest. Whoever gets the ball closest to the end of the bridge without going over gets a pop on the next hole. I expertly bowled my ball across the 60-foot incline. It was easily my best shot of the day. At the 13th tee box, Chuck hit first. Then I stepped up and went to retrieve a ball from my pocket. Similar to the coffee mug incident, my right hand fell asleep. I looked down to see if it was even in my pocket, and it was. With a strange rigor mortis grip, I managed to extract a ball, tee, and for some reason a repair tool. But my brain couldn't make my hand open again. I used my left hand to pry my fingers open and kept the fact that I couldn't feel my right hand, and now part of my right arm, to myself. I just pegged the ball with my left hand, gripped my forewood the best I could, and as I stared at the green scribbles on my ball, the right side of my face went numb. I pulled the club back and swung meagerly, dribbling a shot 40 yards to the left. I was no longer deflated about my round. I was scared. Chuck looked at me and asked, "Yo, what's going on with you, man? You don't seem right." I told him my right arm was completely numb, and my face and lips were starting to tingle. I picked up my ball and told Chuck to keep playing, and that I would just keep him company in the cart. He finished the hole and kept me talking. He would tell me later that he did this to monitor my condition because he suspected what was really happening. Then, words began to escape my brain. I couldn't get them out. Chuck would ask me a question and I would mutter nonsense and then just give up. Something was very wrong. I had no clue what. As he hurried to get me back to the parking lot, I remembered thinking about the passing holes and how I might play them. We went straight to the emergency room at the nearest hospital. I told the nurse what I could, and she had me in a gown and in a room in less than 5 minutes. Then there, sitting alone, I heard an intercom blare the news. Code gray, stroke. Code gray, stroke. The door swung open, and soon I was on a gurney rushing towards the CAT scan room. I can just remember the technician instructing me through a window. "Do not move," she said. I let my breathing slow and tried to relax the best I could, but my ears began filling up with tears that were uncontrollably rolling out of my eyes. "Hey, babe, how was golf?" I couldn't even answer my wife. "Babe?" I just laid on the bed of my hospital room, meekly holding my phone and staring at the point where the ceiling met the wall. I croaked a small cry. She heard it. "Zach, are you okay? What's going on?" Then finally I got something out that was like, "I'm okay. I need you to call my mom. I'm having a stroke." She was panicked, but held strong. I stammered that I needed an MRI at a bigger hospital in Portland to get the full diagnosis. A nurse said they had an ambulance waiting for me, but for cost reasons, there was no way I was about to take that through multiple counties. My foot was down about that. Since we shared my truck, Megan would have to drive me there. So I ordered her an Uber. It would be at the house to pick her up in a few minutes. It was the most difficult call of my 35 years. Megan and I met in 2009 in Los Angeles, and then we moved to Chicago months later, very much in love. During her last semester at Columbia College in 2013, she was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. Since then, I had been by her side for countless MRIs, appointments, and twice-a-day injections of what she describes as hot sauce into my veins. Multiple sclerosis is a confounding, frustrating disease that concerns the thin layer of myelin sheath around the nerves and halts communication between the brain and parts of the body. It has no cure. Life for those with MS revolves around managing the disease's physical and mental effects. Her doctors explained that that meant reducing stress as much as possible and living in a place that doesn't have extreme high or low temperatures. 3 months after her diagnosis and 1 week after her graduation, we rented a minivan and drove to Portland. Now, after years of being by her side and protecting her the best I could, I had to make a call that could very easily spark another episode for her. The nurse understood my ambulance concerns and tearfully said how sorry she was that this was happening. Her emotion had the opposite effect. I became more terrified. Luckily, then Chuck appeared in my room, somber but smiling. He had a book under his arm, and he explained that he had a nice hour and a half of reading in the waiting room. To this day, he still loans me books, mostly with spines well over an inch wide. He gave me a hug and I melted into it, buried my cheek into his shoulder, and sobbed. He eased into a chair. I went back to the bed and we just sat in each other's company. I knew I'd be indebted to him for the rest of our years. Finally, Chuck gave way to Megan and more tears. But the doctors explained that every minute counted in a stroke situation, so we got in the truck and launched on the I-84 back to Portland. I was not able to speak much, but Megan comforted me and told me that my mother had the first flight out to Portland from Indianapolis the next morning. I watched the Columbia River and its endless trees go by. I remember looking up at Multnomah Falls as we passed and the sheer energy that was pumping water over its edge. Nature slowly turned into homes, then boxy warehouse buildings, then apartments and public transit trains. I knew we were near Providence, Portland. Naturally, I put Golf Channel on in the hospital room and just stared at Megan. We communicated with our eyes. She made me smile. I wondered if this would be the way we would interact for the rest of our lives. At least we knew our way around the place. I mean, I'd taken Megan to this same floor, the same hospital for regular MRIs for her brain and spine over the past 6 years. But after my MRI, there was nothing to do but wait. For the next hour, waves of mini-strokes slammed into me. My right hand would go numb, and this ghost feeling would travel up my shoulder, then to my right cheek and my lips. I did the best I could to explain them to Megan. I can't feel my arm. My fingers sting. I feel like there's a fish hook in my lip. Oh, my face feels dead. Finally, five neurologists entered the room, and they didn't have any good news. They were unsure what was causing the headaches and the mini-strokes. Despite dealing with strokes every day, they have never encountered what was happening to me. They could see the blood clot in my vein, and they put me on IV blood thinners and pain meds, but they needed more time for a diagnosis. I wiggled my toes under a knitted throw blanket just to prove I could do it. But later that night, I was admitted to a room on the 8th floor, the stroke floor. My nurse was temporarily puzzled, listening to my heartbeat, until she realized that nearly every other patient up here was decades older than me. She divulged that I was the youngest person she had ever seen on the floor, and she Velcroed my legs into booties that circulated air to keep blood from clotting while I was in bed. I crashed into a deep sleep. It was a hell of a day. I woke the next morning, really early, to a prick in the arm as the nurse drew blood into a rainbow of colored vials. A few hours later, my mom burst into the room, in time to hear the good news. The neurologist assigned to my case, Dr. Rontal, had arrived at a diagnosis. See, I had a central venous sinus thrombosis, or CVST. The blood in the main artery of my brain, the artery that separates the right and left hemispheres, it was clotted and couldn't move blood from the heart to the brain and vice versa. He explained that it's a rare condition, affecting just 5 in 1,000,000, from infants to the elderly. The chances of a male at my age having it were even smaller. Actually, in the meantime, I had done some math, and it was something like 0.8 in 1,000,000. Between the diagnosis and the fact that I hadn't had a mini stroke for 5 hours, Dr. Rontal felt confident that I could be discharged. We were pleasantly stunned. So, flanked by my two favorite women, wife and my mom, I limped out to my truck. We should have kept that parking spot. Our first stop was at the supermarket to pick up food and prescriptions. It was like a dream sequence. So many people were just about their normal day, and I was just struggling to put one foot in front of the other after this life-altering experience. I still had a fair amount of painkillers in me, and I just remembered it just felt like a dream. Then, I ran into my friend Fro in the frozen food aisle. He was pushing a cart, and we had just played in a tournament 3 days prior to this, and it was obvious that he had heard the news. "What the fuck are you doing here?" he asked. "I don't know," I said to him, and he just leaned in and hugged me hard. I went to bed early that night and left Megan and Mom in the living room watching TV together. I tried to ignore the numbness returning in my arms, and this time in the left as well as the right. And by 3 a.m., the pain in my head was too much. My mother heard me stumbling around the house, grasping for Tylenol, just in time to see me crash into the bathroom, throwing up uncontrollably. So, 8 strange hours after leaving, we waved hello to the same nurses as I re-entered the hospital at the emergency room. As I was in much worse shape than my first visit, they introduced me to the frightening power of fentanyl. I told myself that the pharmacist wasn't actually wearing a Venetian death mask like one from the cover of Medeski Martin and Wood's Uninvincible album. But in my state, I couldn't really be 100% sure. By the third dose, I really wanted no more, but it didn't seem like I had a choice. Before losing consciousness that final time, I made peace with never seeing Megan again or playing another round with Chuck. Hours stretched into days. Doctors and nurses pulled me back from the brink and off the fentanyl, but Dr. Rontal still couldn't determine what had gone wrong. In between his maddening visits, I began working with a speech therapist. She was relentlessly positive, and she needed to be. We started from the beginning. "Give me as many animals as you can in 60 seconds," she said, hitting her stopwatch on a string that took the place of a stethoscope. "Go." I started off strong, firing off 4 quick ones, but the blood in my brain quickly went to concrete. "That's time." "And?" I asked. She said, "You got 7. The devastating reality hit me that, whatever the diagnosis, it would be a long road back. On day 5, Dr. Rontal appeared with an unfamiliar look on his face, a smile. He announced that he had solved the puzzle. I had kept myself entertained by trying to keep track of the number of times nurses took my blood. I was currently at 60 vials. It turns out my blood was the problem. Dr. Rontal said I had factor 5 Leiden, a hereditary condition that is essentially a mutation of red blood cells. It can go largely unannounced for people who have it, and others like me can have their lives unexpectedly torn apart. Friendly advice, guys and girls, go get your blood checked. Dr. Rontal had a detailed plan of action, including a roster of medications and blood thinners, along with my speech therapy and no work for 60 days. Then he asked what physical activities I enjoyed. "Cycling and golf," I told him. He nixed all bike riding for the foreseeable future and paused and smiled again. "Play as much golf as possible." Seeing that I had experienced some legitimate hallucinations over the past week, I looked around to make sure if this was real. Megan was grinning. No death masks. Dr. Rontal wasn't shape-shifting. He explained that much of what goes into golf, like walking, simple addition, problem-solving, hand-eye coordination, it all lined up perfectly for stroke rehab. Recovery would be grueling, he warned, but I'd get there. We scheduled my next MRI for December 17th, The next few months would be critical, so it was imperative that we follow his instructions. After this avalanche of pain, confusion, and fear, suddenly I was catapulted into the opposite end of the emotional spectrum, gifted with every diehard's fantasy: stop working, play golf all day, doctor's orders. On the first day home, I filled up my weekly pill tray and assessed the new normal. The hot water from the shower still made my hands and arms tingle like electricity was coursing through them. But rather than panic or cry, I just let the anxiety wash into excitement about what was ahead. I had permission to drive, somehow, and I hit Powell's City of Books in downtown Portland. My speech therapist recommended crossword puzzles and literature that could keep my attention. I left there with the New York Times Beginner's Luck Easy Crosswords by Will Shorts, a fancy new mechanical pencil, and a dream threesome of books from Tom Coyne, Harvey Penick, and Tom Doak. I got home, put them down, and began plotting my first round back. I really wasn't ready. My walk was more of an exaggerated limp, and I was constantly groggy from the daily cocktail of meds. But Dr. Rontal said the process would start slowly. So, on the morning of my fourth day out of the hospital, I drove through a light but persistent drizzle and pulled into my local muni, Eastmoreland Golf Course, in southeast Portland. I didn't have the energy to be giddy, but I felt so good to resume the golfer's routine of paying for my round and heading out to roll some practice putts. Flashbacks from Indian Creek flooded my head as I reached down in the bag to grab three balls. My right hand was still in pins and needles, but hey, at least this time it opened. Throwing balls down and then stepping over them, my unsteady putting stroke looked like the spikes from my heart rate monitor, and I could already feel my body flagging. Joy turned into trepidation as I walked to the first tee box. With the obvious truth of the round ahead, I took the scorecard out of my back pocket and slid it into the side pocket of my bag. I put a ball on a tee and took a cautious practice swing. Thankfully, I was alone. I was briefly buoyed when I struck it well. Not great, but certainly better than my last tee shot with Chuck. It was obvious from the first steps off the tee that I had bitten off way too much. Felt like I was lugging an overstuffed backpacking bag rather than my golf clubs. And by the time I reached my ball on the fairway, I had developed an exit plan. I'd play numbers 1 and 2, and then I'd reroute to the 7th and literally limp my way back in. My 130-gram shafts felt heavier with each swing. It was a relief to drag my ball out of the 9th hole. I just wanted to go home. Megan was excited to hear about how it went, and all I could say is that I was hungry and tired. Just defeated. I suggested using pushcarts for a while until I had the strength to carry my bag. She said I should make an appointment with my instructor and try the range. Megan really is a brilliant woman. Robert Randall out of Redtail Golf Center is my dude. Nice shout out, Robert. We had worked together for about a year. There's nothing like vibing with your instructor. I took some swings while he finished up with another student and I immediately felt better. Not having to limp around the course with an unwieldy bag freed me up to concentrate on my swing. I had new feels and a new swing thought. Square to the ball. Don't lift the club head, lift your hands. Settle. Take the club back, swing through the ball. Hold your pose. Yeah, I know, it was a lot, but it helped. I quit thinking about the unfair hand I'd been dealt and I just hit golf balls. Robert made his way over and dove in with the regular small talk. How you playing? Anything in particular you're working on? How's your last round? I shook my head and came right out with it. Man, I had a stroke last week, and I just got out of the hospital. Robert just stared back for a beat. Then he admitted that I looked different, and I gave him my practice much shorter version of the news. Bottom line, nothing but golf for the next couple of months. He reacted the way I'd hoped everybody would. He just nodded, asked me what club I had and where my aim point was. I pulled 8-iron and began hitting balls toward an electrical pole in the distance. Robert aligned TrackMan and off we went. It felt like a beginning. He was usually quick to give his thoughts, but this time he kept his head on the screen and I just kept hitting. I switched to 6-iron, banged balls at the same target in the distance until he finally called me off. He said, "All right, this is crazy. You improved your path and face dramatically. I've never seen anything like this." Somehow, my new normal now included hitting a beautiful cut. "How do you feel?" he asked. And usually when players have a breakthrough of this magnitude, it's cause for champagne and high fives. I'm just really tired, I confessed. We kept talking as I took my glove off, signaling that my one-hour session was done after 25 minutes. We stood there in the hitting bay and talked about my newfound appreciation for life. I told him I would never take this game for granted. We talked about swinging easy and just playing when I was able. He suggested that I used a push cart to help with the walk and weight. I gave him a hug and booked my next session. The conversation continued when I got home. Megan and I discussed golf, but really we were just talking about recovery, about how it felt to connect my brain down to my hands when I hit the ball. Then I told her about my new theory that if I could drop 35 grams from each club and convert from steel to graphite, my body would thank me. Now, I'm not sure if she entirely got that part, but she happily gave me the green light to buy whatever I needed to get it done. So began my career as a club builder. I hopped online and found a starter kit. I bought a hand torch, a shaft puller, epoxy, and a vise. I ordered 5-3P set of 95 gram steel fiber. I went to Home Depot and got a belt sander and a workbench and a pancake air compressor. I reached out to Patrick Boyd at Boyd Blade and Ferrule and placed another order of ferrules. Well, except for this time, I'd be putting them on and turning them myself. I fell instantly in love. I understand that some players are less particular about what's in their bag. I'm definitely not one of those people. Golf is extremely visual for me, from the landscapes to the tools. I spent hours on a stool working at my makeshift bench, gobbling up golf podcasts and feeling my brain emerge from the mire. Gearhart Golf Links claims that its 1892 opening makes it the oldest course west of the Mississippi River. More immediately for me, at 6,200 fairly flat yards, it's approachable and fun, perfect for my 18-hole return. My buddy Hayes and I left early in the morning, Hayes, and I hopped on the 26 West. It had been 2 weeks since the stroke, and this time I was giddy. We rapped about life. I was moving forward with mine. He was moving to Florida. His father took warfarin as a part of his daily regimen, and so did I. At mile marker 28, I pulled off to get 5 gallons of water from the spring tap to bring home. I'd always filled up prior to the stroke, and doing it again felt like a reminder that my life was back on track, or trying to be. I tossed the blue camping jug into the back of my Tacoma, another victory, and drove on. On the Gearhart practice green, my putting stroke was noticeably leveled out, and the push cart for my bag was a revelation. We both found the fairway off the first, and I took immense pleasure in simply walking with both hands on the cart, the wheels ahead of me. Instead of technical thoughts or strategy, my time between shots was spent concentrating on things like walking normally again and my next club build. I was exhausted after 12 holes, but had no problem finishing the final six. Hayes and I laughed all around. He's a tough guy, a former hockey player, so I was surprised to see him tearing up when he took his hat off to shake hands after the last putt dropped. He gave me a big hug and welcomed me back to the game. I said I would miss him, and I really meant that. For the next few weeks, I stalked the fairways of Eastmoreland. Exhaustion and tingles were part of the deal, but I could feel both improving. Physically, I was trending in the right direction for the December MRI. The mental side was a different story. You know the things your parents said when you were a kid about you really don't want it to be Christmas every day? Well, they were right. In between shots, now I found myself longing for a pace of a working life. I love being a freelance sound mixer in the commercial and TV world of film production, and I still physically couldn't go back. News of my condition had flashed through the tight-knit Portland film community. I worried about getting any work in the future and if I could even handle it if I did. On top of that, I desperately missed my family in Indiana. I found myself blinking through sudden tears before tee shots. Something had to be done. Once again, Megan to the rescue. She rearranged schedules and we booked flights to Indianapolis. I was still thrashed on the inside, but nostalgia and love enveloped me from the second we arrived. I didn't bring my clubs, but my father had more than enough to fill a light carry bag with a short set and a driver. My parents lived across the street from Bearslide Golf Club, a hidden gem that I can't count how many times I've played. Portland's rain followed me east, and the parking lot was as empty as the tee sheet. No one in the house wanted to play, but I had to. The club pro, Mark Wiseman, found me in the pro shop. And one look at his face told me my dad had already told him what had happened. This was kind of a look that I started getting used to. He smiled, wouldn't accept any money, and sent me out. Bear Slide is an awesome design, with the front playing on a linksy, open plot of land, similar to the surrounding cornfields, with heathered rough and long, fun holes. The back brings some elevation changes and a long creek that meanders in and out of the course. I went off the back and did my favorite rerouting of that course. I'd start at number 10 and 11, and then I'd take the maintenance path, cut over to the 15th tee that plays down over that creek, and then I'd play through 18. This six-hole run has five par fours and a short elevated par three. And during my long weekend, I trekked the loop as much as possible. When I got greedy, I'd mix in numbers 1 and 9. They're two great par fours that are separated by a long, large pond. When I wasn't at Bear Slide, my mom, dad, and my brother Brady kept me close. Megan and I also saw my close friends Eric and Stacy and David and Lindsay. It was a shot of medicine better than any fentanyl. It was time to finish what we'd started. I called Chuck and told him I was ready to play 18. He made us a time at his club. Pumpkin Ridge is where Tiger Woods won his third consecutive U.S. amateur title in 1996, his last event before going pro. It also hosts the Korn Ferry Tour's Winco Foods Portland Open, where in 2019, Brendan Todd earned his PGA card with a comeback story of his own. For me, it was just where things got back to normal. Chuck and I pushed our carts and joked about how I was hitting it just a little better than I did during our last round together, which ended in me going to the emergency room. We talked about regular, non-stroke things. My swing thoughts and stuttering were starting to be improved. Chuck remarked on how well I was playing, then he proceeded to thump me 15-3. Again, pretty normal. Over the coming weeks, more time at Eastmoreland and in my makeshift club building garage pulled my handicap into the single digits. I thought about my brother and how it was finally time to beat his ass in a money game. Brady, if you're listening to this, pick a place and set it up right now. I'll be there anywhere you call it. Golf strengthened my body to the point where in early December I began picking up small contract work. Mentally and emotionally, I was also changed. I treasured my new friendships within the golf world, and I was grateful for all the positives in my life. Still, I was nervous as hell walking into the hospital on December 19th, 2 days after that MRI. Dr. Rontal entered the room with the same smile he did the last time I saw him. He congratulated me for the progress that I made. The blood clot in my brain was still there, but it was subsiding significantly, and the likelihood of another catastrophic event was very low. He shook my hand and told me to keep up the good work and keep playing golf. This appointment took just a few minutes. This time, I couldn't call Megan fast enough. Then I called my parents. They had recently retired to South Carolina, neighboring Kiawah Island, and we were spending the holidays with them. Megan and I had already planned several rounds together at Seabrook Island, my parents' new home club. My brother Brady and I had an early tee time at the Ocean Course on Kiawah on New Year's Day. The morning we left Portland, I threw our bags in the back of the truck. As we headed to the airport, the sun poked through the clouds.
And now, very fortunate to have Zach with us today to update us on his progress. Zach, a lot of time has passed since you wrote that story, and certainly since the events. You know, there's the editing, there's the writing, the editing, the printing, that whole process, and then it finally comes out. So it's been a while. How are you? Tell us about your progress. Tell us, how are you doing?
I'm fully back to work. And I'm a location sound mixer, so I do feature films and commercials. Work is good. The stress was the main thing I was worried about. But I am able to do my job in very high stress situations and not really feel that affected. I think the main thing is sort of some memory stuff. I feel a little bit sluggish at times, and almost like I've got some kind of short form amnesia or something. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's even the right word, but yeah, I just sort of go with the punches now. I mean, I'm dealing with my brain and my life as a new normal. I just try to try to keep busy, but not too busy. So I don't want to be sitting in my living room watching golf tournaments. I'd rather be out golfing. I've had a wonderful opportunity to go work at McKenzie Golf Bags when I'm not working. They actually are right down the street from my house. Wow. So I've been there finishing bags for them for the past couple of months, and I'm going to continue to do that through the summer and as long as they need it. They're wonderful people there, good friends.
Shout out to Ian Kritzer. Is he there over there?
Yeah, I work with Ian and Nick every day, and then the very wonderful, talented sewers there. It's all in-house and just a wonderful team of people. And sort of with that, just leaning into the other facets of the golf world. I've gotten to know staff at the Golfers Journal through their events, which, I mean, I'll plug that right now and say, if anybody's listening to this and you've got something near you or a place that you've wanted to play for a long time, you should just sign up and go, because these events, they really pay for themselves by way of experiences. And I mean, you get some pretty good goodies too, but everybody's just been wonderful. So yeah, as of right now, I think that I don't have any more recovery to look forward to. I think that where I'm at is where I'm at. It's caused me to live a lot healthier lifestyle, which is wonderful. And in reading like the Sober League, it is a bit strange at times because, there's no drinking is not in the cards, although I've tried to drink beers, and basically every morning that I wake up, I feel like I have a hangover. So any beer that I drink is not going to add to that. So, it's a blessing, all of it. And my game isn't that great right now, but, I can't really blame that on anyone but myself. That's the way golf goes. But yeah, the up and up is that I'm able to play, and that's really all that I focus on, is how lucky I am to still be here.
Exactly. You say there, it's all a blessing. You mentioned the Sober League story, and people would read that and might say, oh, I feel so sorry for you, you can't drink anymore. And my take on that is it's all a blessing, and it's hard for sometimes for people to get it. How would you explain that to someone? What do you mean by it's all a blessing?
I think that with the regularity in the game and also in the country of America with drinking, is that you don't really realize how life is without it until you don't do it. And I think that it's quite the unlock when you give that up. Causes a great deal of stress in my life personally, if I was drinking. That the way that it is that you don't have a fog and a stress, and you can really be yourself without the guise or any kind of, it's funny that I can't finish the sentence, but it's, you don't have a veil. You don't have a veil over things, is what I was trying to say.
Yeah. But what are the blessings that are the recovery, aside from alcohol, that are the things that come into your life because of, this event that very nearly took your life, but now looking at it with the perspective of saying, okay, look at all these things that it's brought into my life.
Sure. I just see the game and being able to still experience it and go play it. I see it a lot differently than I had before, and that's through literally using it to help me walk again, with a normal gait. I shouldn't even be able to do much more than walk down the street with my dog and my wife. And now I'm able to continue golfing. I'm a very, very hyperactive person. And if I wasn't able to move around, I don't know what the heck I'd do. Just the blessing to be able to still swing clubs and sometimes swing them really well, to be able to use my brain in a way to continue to drive myself as a golfer and play my best game. I've broke 80 plenty times since this happened. Nice. So to be able to score, I mean, it's very, very fun. And I still have that excitement, like making a birdie or a couple of back-to-back birdies. I mean, the excitement is still there. And to be able to have that excitement around the game of golf and to be able to recognize that after having this event happen, I mean, it does, it never escapes me how lucky I am. So I'd say that's probably the best way that I could answer that. I mean, golf really is a gift. And if people find it the way that we find it, who read the journal, who want to like be this kind of golfer, I mean, it really is the coolest, most fun, most rewarding thing that you can do with your free time. And you, Tom, I mean, you're doing it full time, and like New York Times bestseller is a pretty cool thing. So, thanks, I mean, it can really be anything you want it to be for you. It's wonderful.
That's really well put. Thank you. And I love that you're still grinding, right, for numbers, because it'd be easy to say, well, I'm just glad I can, you know, hit a golf ball, and which would be great and miraculous. But I love that you're still like, hey, dude, like I'm trying to make a number here. You know, I feel like that's how I'd be as well. Like it's the numbers still matter. And you want to see, like, that's also a great way to measure your progress as well, to say like, okay, if I can still make this number, you know, I'm in a certain place, which has got to be kind of a cool barometer that golf gives you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a pretty cool game. And I mean, I guess the one thing I didn't lose is I'm still a nut, still a crazy golfer, you know, still have that, yeah, like that fever.
Absolutely. How's the feedback been from readers? I'm sure folks, Golfers Journal readers are great. And that one, they read the magazine, and two, they'll reach out to you and be in touch. It's very much a community. So what have you heard from folks?
I've had a lot of strangers sending me messages and Instagram, reaching out, thanking me for sharing the story. Everybody has been absolutely wonderful. I've met quite a few people at the events who have come up to me later in the day and said, oh, you're the guy who wrote that story. I would have had no idea. That's awesome. Cool. The feedback from my mom, who was pretty big part of it, was kind of sombering. She reached out saying I had no idea that things were that bad. And I don't know. I think that was a really difficult part of it, is I looked like I was pretty good, but it was all behind the face, you know, still in the brain, recovering. So it's really, really good to be able to share the story with anybody who wanted to know about what happened, whether they're close to me or not. To be able to share that internationally was really, really wild. And when Travis and the team came back and said, yeah, we've got the final edits, the thing is done, and I received my first copy, like a forward copy or whatever, before everything was shipped out, it was kind of a whoa, okay. Like, now a lot of people who I have no idea who they are about to read some really personal stuff about my life. And I mean, I'll talk to anybody, but I sort of wear my personal life underneath my sleeve. So it's good to be able to share this stuff, and the feedback has been absolutely amazing.
Good.
And I mean,
I'm glad to hear that. Yeah. That makes it worthwhile, because I hear you. That feeling of like, it's fine when you're sitting around banging on the keys in your office, right? And you're like, this feels good, and I'm getting some stuff out, and then you turn it over, and then you see it in a magazine, and you're like, holy, what did I do? And so I mean, I still get that. But yeah, when you get some feedback, it feels like, that was the point, you know, being vulnerable. It was worth it. I mean, you helped a lot of people, Zach.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. And I mean, that's one of the goals that I didn't even know was a part of it. Right. The people who have reached out and said, thank you. I've been dealing with my own recovery of things, and this really makes me helpful, or really opens my eyes to use golf in such a way. And I put that all towards the neurologist, Dr. Rontal, who told me to do that. Cause I never really thought that golf would be that. I thought I was done playing golf when I was in the hospital.
What a great doctor. You found the right doc, man.
Really? I was laying on the bed and I looked at Megan and my mom and said, I mean, you heard this, right? Yeah. And I mean, truly off I went. Like, I went straight to the bookstore to get some stuff, and then I was straight to the golf course, and we were in the start of rainy season here. I just went right for it, and it was really good. But yeah, when Casey reached out to me saying he wanted this to be an audio piece, that was kind of a whoa moment, because I can't really get through it myself without crying. So you can hear it in the parts. I mean, there's still parts that really hit me. Just the thought of it, and then saying it out loud, it gets kind of hard.
Yeah.
It was a very, very scary thing, but got through it.